If you don't have a handout, there's one right there. Does anybody need one? It's right there on that table. Tonight we're looking at Acts chapter 21, verses 18 through 39. Paul's return to Jerusalem kind of concluded the third missionary journey. And the price of being misunderstood. And Paul paid a great price in being misunderstood. If you're going to try to accomplish anything for the Lord in a significant way, you are going to be persecuted for doing what's right and for standing for what's right, and often you're going to be misunderstood. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote this, "To be great is to be misunderstood." Albert Hubbard expressed it more eloquently this way in his fine book, Love, Life, and Work. He states, "The man who is anybody and who does anything is surely going to be criticized, vilified, and misunderstood. This is part of the penalty of greatness, and every great man understands it and understands, too, that it is no proof of greatness. The final proof of greatness lies in being able," and listen to this, "to endure being misunderstood and criticism without resentment." No one worked harder at communicating the truth that we're aware of than the Apostle Paul. He is going to make his way from Ephesus. And we saw how he took that ship and stopped many places as he made his way finally to Caesarea Maritime and then traveled to Jerusalem, even when being told by the Spirit of God that he was going to suffer at the hands of people in Jerusalem, even when being or trying to be persuaded not to go to Jerusalem, because trouble awaited him there, Paul said that he had to go. And since no one could persuade him, he makes his way there. And we'll pick up in verse 17, because that's where we finished last week. And after we, that's Luke and the entourage there with Paul, and he's going to drop that after this, and he's just going to start talking about Paul, even though they're with him, because the shift is going to go from the ministry of the church in Jerusalem and Antioch and the churches that Paul met and presented, from him reaching those type of people on his first three missionary journeys and with his desire to go to Rome, it's going to shift to him having an audience in front of kings and rulers. But it's going to come at a great cost for Paul. But it's really going to, God's going to use it to open the door for the rest of the people that will come behind Paul and lay the foundation for him. So it says in verse 17, "After we arrived in Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And the following day, Paul went in with James," that's the half-brother of Jesus. He was the elder of the church of Jerusalem, along with the apostles that kept their headquarters there and settled doctrinal disputes until the canon of Scripture was complete. Antioch, Syria, was kind of the hub for sending out missionaries that we talked about, but still the main focus on doctrine and theology and things being settled was in Jerusalem. And James played a big part in that. He's also the one that wrote the letter that holds and bears his name. So Paul goes and meets with James, and all the elders were present. This is, Paul's going to give a report to this group about his missionary work. And then they're going to share the rumor that's going to go that's going around about Paul. And that's where the misunderstanding comes. So in verse 19, it says, after he, Paul, had greeted them, he began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. So Paul's just kind of outlaying his trips. He's given a slide presentation, like, you know, we have missionaries that come, and they always, back in the day, even before we had this kind of stuff, they would use little trays of slide projectors, you know, and they'd have that little deal they'd click and everything. They'd just show picture after picture after picture of things, and now, you know, PowerPoint and the presentations. But Paul's given a snapshot, a verbal snapshot of his three missionary journeys. And he's given this report to James and the elders, the ones that he feels ultimately responsible to there in Jerusalem. Paul never felt like that he was at the top and everybody else was beneath him. If anything, he didn't even really feel like he was equal with them. He felt superior to them. And he gives this detailed information about how the Word of God and the Gospel had spread throughout Asia, over into Macedonia, down even to Corinth, and back up through that whole region that he had covered. And I'm sure he had great stories to tell. And I suspect Paul was a great storyteller. Then in verse 20, he states this. He says, and when they heard it, they began glorifying God. Now, he's talking to the people that are in his camp. He's preaching to the choir. They get it. They understand, because they were involved also, if you remember in Acts chapter 15, with the Jerusalem Council. You remember what happened at the Jerusalem Council? The Judaizers, who were still holding on to the old way, they kind of saw Judaism as the big umbrella, and they accepted Christianity as a small umbrella that was covered by the big umbrella of Judaism. So they said, listen, it's okay for you to believe this, but you still got to keep the law. You still got to be circumcised. You still got to follow the Mosaic law. And you still got to eat the right kind of food, the dietary law. Well, if you'll remember, they came to the conclusion in the Jerusalem Council, and Paul went, and they met with the apostles and the elders, and they came to the conclusion that, listen, you did not have to be circumcised in order to be saved. Because basically what they were saying is, before you can become a Christian, you got to become a Jew. And after you become a Jew, then you can believe in Christ. And one of the things that must happen, according to Genesis chapter 17, is you have to be circumcised, because that was a sign of the Abrahamic covenant. That was a sign that you were a descendant of Abraham. And when we studied the book of Romans, if you'll remember, 9, 10, and 11, Paul points out that God has not forsaken Israel. But prior to that, Paul also said that not all descendants of Abraham are sons of Abraham. What he meant is, not all physical descendants of Abraham are spiritual descendants of Abraham. The only way that you become a spiritual descendant is not through keeping the law, not through circumcision, not through not eating certain foods, but by believing in Jesus Christ. You become a spiritual descendant of Abraham. And if you'll remember, he uses that verse that Abraham is known for and is repeated in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Nowhere does it say Abraham obeyed God in getting circumcised. Abraham obeyed God in fulfilling all of the laws. Abraham obeyed God. No, it says God. Abraham believed God, exercised faith, and he credited it to him as righteousness. So he makes it very clear that our righteousness does not come from the law, that no man has ever been saved by keeping the law. Then what comes in is this little fine nitpicking semantics of words. The Judaizers would say, well, okay, Paul, and the Catholics fell into this trap. Okay, you're saved by faith, but you are justified by works. So in order to remain saved, you've got to do X, Y, Z. And the whole book of Galatians, Paul argues that, is that, listen, you are saved by faith and you are justified by faith. That's the big misunderstanding. Now, that got solved between the leaders of the church, the apostles, and Paul when it came to Gentiles becoming believers. So they came to the conclusion they do not have to be circumcised. They do not have to keep the law. But let's request, for the sake of unity, that they abstain from eating certain kinds of meat. And so basically they were saying, listen, because we have some weaker brothers that can't handle the fact that they don't have to keep the law, they don't have to be circumcised, they don't have to do this, they don't have to do that, but we would prefer, even though it doesn't change anything, it's just going to kind of help smooth the unity and help settle things down, if they will not eat and kind of obey the dietary law till things kind of grow in maturity, so to speak. So, middle of verse 20 says, and they said to him, you see, brother, here's the thing. He gives a report. They're glorifying God. And then it's almost like somebody giving you a bunch of compliments, and then they say, but. They say, you see, brother, how many thousands, and this is the same word that's used over in the Gospels for myriads of angels, tens of thousands. They say, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are zealous for the law. In other words, they believed in Christ, but they just cannot let go of keeping the law. They're zealous for it. And they have been told. Now, I've had at every church that I've been at a problem, and most pastors have, by people telling something that I either said or did that I neither said nor did. It's a rumor, or it's you've been misunderstood or misquoted or something. And listen, it spreads like wildfire. That's what happens to Paul. Listen, this group of Jews, thousands of them, man, they're believers, and they're zealous for the law, and they have been told, verse 21, they have been told about you that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. Now, you go back, you'll not find anywhere that Paul did that. In fact, Paul did right the opposite. What did he do with Timothy? He had Timothy circumcised so that it wouldn't be a stumbling block. So there's this rumor going around, and it says in the middle of verse 21, telling them not to circumcise their children nor walk according to the customs. That's the law. So they're going to ask Paul to do something to kind of to help settle things down. And Paul, is going to make a gesture of good faith to try to settle it down. So this is how this unfolds. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Listen, word's going to get out that you're here. And it's not going to be good. Therefore, do this that we tell you. In other words, we got a favor to ask of you, Paul. We have four men who are under a vow. This is the Nazarite vow. Now, a couple of people, one being John the Baptist, the other one kind of fell trapped to this young lady named Delilah, that took a lifetime Nazarite vow. One of the things was they were not to eat any food that would ferment, like grapes and prunes and things like that. Not drink any wine or any fermented liquid. A strict diet. And they were to not let a razor touch their head, including their face. So their hair just grew and they're kind of like mine and their beard went. And by the way, I did not take the Nazarite vow. Now, some took it temporarily, but in order to get out of it, it cost them greatly, because what they would have to do is they would have to go through a ritual of purification, and they would have to make sacrifices in the temple area, not in the Holy of Holies, but in the temple area. And when they would make these sacrifices, the meat that was left over that was used for sacrifice would feed all of those in the temple court. So you're looking at, 300 to 500 people. Not a lot of food. A lot of food. So it was expensive to get out of it. I tell you all that because here's what they're going to ask Paul to do. We've got four men who are under the Nazarite vow. Take them and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. See, in the end, everybody's trying to get looking like me. And all will know that there is nothing to these things which they have been told about you. In other words, they're saying, listen, Paul, help us out. Publicly go in with these four guys, pay all their expenses for them, let them get purified and sacrifice the animals and get cleaned up and shave and fulfill their vow by paying it off. And by doing so, those that have started this rumor will realize that you are not telling people that they got to keep the law, or that you are demonstrating by getting them to perform the customs that you're all for that. So that's what he concludes with in verse 24. But that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. In other words, Paul, be an example that you're keeping the law like you're supposed to, like they think you're supposed to. Then in verse 25, but concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we wrote having decided that they should abstain from the meat sacrificed to idols and from the blood and from what is strangled and from fornication. Now, what are they talking about? What was decided at the Jerusalem Council? Yeah, listen, we know that we've already talked to these Gentiles who believed that they didn't have to get circumcised, they didn't have to keep the law, and we decided that they should abstain. You go back and review your notes or reread chapter 15 of Acts. That's what they came to the conclusion. Now, Paul does all this, and there's going to become another false accusation. So Paul fulfills what they said. Then Paul, and a lot of people said Paul compromised. I think Paul was trying to say, you know what? For the sake of unity, for the sake of settling everything down, I'll go do that. Now, I don't know what was in the back of Paul's mind, because I don't even know what was in the front of Paul's mind. But I know this, Paul did not compromise. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself along with them, went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them. Now that's a hefty price Paul pays. So here's another false accusation that's going to come along. When the 7 days were almost over, 7 days of the purification, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple. Now, where's Asia? That's all Ephesus and all that area where he came from. And Jews there. Who ran Paul out of Ephesus? The Jews. Right? Remember, when he was on his way back, he couldn't even go into Ephesus and meet with the elders. He had the elders come and meet with him. So these Jews make their way from Asia, probably specifically Ephesus, and upon seeing him, Paul, in the temple, began to stir up the crowd and laid hands on him. That didn't mean that they laid hands on him like we lay hands on somebody that we're ordaining or sending out on the mission field. This means they laid hands on him. They seized him. Now, who do you think these Jews learned about stirring up the crowd from? Remember a guy named Demetrius, a silversmith? He got the crowd stirred up, right? Verse 28, crying out. This is what the Jews from Asia, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches that all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." Not true. Never happened. Now, he might have brought them into the temple, but he didn't bring them into the temple. They had the court of Gentiles outside. Now, what they're talking about, which is interesting, what they're talking about in that temple, there was a dividing wall. Now, let me test your ability or your memory. Where have you heard about a dividing wall before? Ephesians chapter 2, verses 11 through 22. And what does Paul say there? He says, listen, here's the mystery. Something that has not been revealed in the past, but now is being revealed, that Jews and Gentiles are no longer enemies of one another. And not only that, they are one. For, you go back and read it in Genesis, or Ephesians. "For you who were formerly far off have been brought near. The dividing wall has been torn down. And the two shall be one." That's what they're talking about. But listen, Paul didn't do that. Paul didn't violate taking Gentiles into the wrong place of the temple. In fact, they never even witnessed that. And the reason I know that they didn't witness it is because it didn't happen. Some of you will remember an incident here at the church, and not too long after I was here, and I remember standing up and only making this comment about it, saying, listen, just because somebody says I said something doesn't mean I said it. Then notice what he says. Verse 29. "For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with him. And they supposed..." They did what? They took a leap that Paul had brought him into the temple. So they see this guy from the church in Ephesus, this Ephesian, Trophimus, and they see Paul walking around with him in the city. And they come to the wrong conclusion. Well, Paul must have taken him into the temple. But he didn't. Then in verse 30, it says, then all the city was provoked. The old mob syndrome. And the people rushed together. And taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple. And immediately the doors were shut. Now, Rome did not care what the Jews did. They're in control of Jerusalem, the Roman Empire. They have Roman guards posted around because the Jews had freedom to do anything they wanted to do religiously until it crossed the line politically. And the emperor in Rome was fearful that the Jews might get so uproared that they would mount an attack against the Roman province and take over. So to the northwest corner of the temple, they had about 300 to 500 guards, Roman guards there, overseeing the activities of the temple. Now, Rome did not want the temple to be there or to be built. Their fear was that it was too well fortified and that they could use it for a fortress in an upheaval of trying to get freedom away from Rome. As long as there wasn't any political upheaval, remember, what did the Jews convince Rome about Jesus? He was claiming to be a king. That he was a king of the Jews, not Caesar. Then the other thing that they, two things basically that they wanted. No political riots and send in the taxes. Other than that, you can do whatever you want to do. So notice what takes place here. I entitled this little section here 31 through 36. It reminded me of that deal when we lived in Dallas. It said, don't mess with Texas. Don't mess with Rome either. While they were seeking to kill him, that's Paul, a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. The last thing Rome wanted and the last thing the commander wanted was a report to get back to Rome that they were allowing a uprising to occur. Now, the reason that they were able, they could witness all of this from their post there on the northwest corner of the temple. So it says, at once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up and took hold of him. So he grabs Paul and ordered him to be bound with two chains. And he began asking who he was and what he had done. Now he's going to come to a conclusion that Paul's somebody else too that causes problems. Verse 34. But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another. And when he could not find out the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. When he got to the stairs leading to the barracks, he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. For the multitude of people kept following him, shouting, "Away with him!" Now, I don't think this has anything to do with what happened to Christ, but the mob started shouting with Christ too, didn't they? Crucify him. We're actually coming up on that. So that's why they get involved. If you're reading along on this on your own and you're going, well, how in the world did the Roman soldiers, why did they get involved? Now you have a little better understanding. Now, Paul's going to flash his credentials or his passport on the way up. He's going to say, "Hey, look, buddies, I got a pedigree here that you don't know about yet. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" Well, he didn't say it in a language that he was expecting. He said it in a language that he could understand. And so the commander said, and he says, "Do you know Greek?" And Paul probably said, "Meganoita." Verse 38, "Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness." No, he wasn't. Now, that happened according to Josephus in about 54 A.D., and he had positioned people up on the Mount of Olives and tried to lead a revolt. And this guy thinks that's who Paul is. Now, if you do a study of the assassins, some conclude that they were an Islamic group that was trying to take over. Now, who eventually took over the temple, the Crusades? Islam. Who controls it now? Islam. The Muslims control it. In fact, when you're there in Jerusalem during the prayer time, and I was telling Dell and Deborah when we were there and that sound was going out, I said, you know, it's just so haunting to be standing in the holy city and hear that chant almost calling for, you know, the Muslims to pray. And I mean, it would echo throughout the whole city, and it was coming from the Temple Mount where the big dome of the rock is. So this guy thinks that's who it is, but Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus, a citizen of no insignificant city." See, Paul had dual citizenship. He was a Jew and he was a Roman. "And I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." Man, I tell you, remember when everything was analog? And I don't know that much about it. I know enough to know that I'm ignorant about it. I remember the first time I figured out the difference between analog and digital. You remember when we had VCRs and you put in a VCR tape or whatever it's called, cassette, and you recorded stuff. And you would watch something, and then you would go, "Oh, I want to watch that again." And you'd have to rewind it, find it, and boom, go back to it. Well, now we have a thing called a DVR. I sort of understand a DVR. It's recording it. And, you know, I can go and replay that, and I can hit a button, and it shows frames. And I can just click on that frame, and it automatically jumps to that section. Now, I sort of understand that. Sort of. And when I say sort of, on a scale of 1 to 100, 100 being I understand it, I'm about a 1.1. Well, let me tell you what I do not understand at all. How I can be watching live TV. Will and I were watching, this is when I first realized that this was possible, years ago after it first came out. Will, my son, who understands it. We were watching something, I went, "Oh man, hey, they need to show that on instant replay." Will grabs a remote, woo, we watch it. I go, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, we're watching it." I said, "Well, we're missing the game. He goes, "No, we're not missing the game." I go, "What are you talking about?" He says, you can keep right on going watching this, or and he jumps to the live action. I go, "Wait a minute, what'd you just do?" And he says, "Oh, you want to watch that replay again?" He's back over there. And then back to live. I said to myself, "Self, that's God and time. God is outside of time. Now, I say all that to say this. My hope is, and it won't matter when I get there, my hope is for all of eternity, be able to sit down and go through the Scriptures, and Jesus is there and He says, hey, let's go and look at what happened when Paul was in front of King Agrippa. Let's take a look at what happened to Paul when he went to Jerusalem. And we just kind of sat back. But instead of sitting back, we just go there. Because he's outside of time. You're talking about the ultimate DVR. I know, that's mind-boggling, isn't it? Yeah, that's heavy. Let me give you three applications to being misunderstood. Because if you serve the Lord faithfully, you will be misunderstood. The first one is this. The reality of misunderstanding is inescapable. The goal for us is not to run it down all the time when we're misunderstood and try to write it up, write R-I-G-H-T, and to cultivate an attitude of not being resentful about being misunderstood. Because that'll destroy you. The second one is this. The reasons for being misunderstood are unpredictable. Some of the things that you do that you don't even give a second thought to, other people will, it'll just ruin them. And they'll just get blown out of the water. And you go, well, I mean, what's the big deal? I mean, that's not what I intended. It's unpredictable. I tell people all the time that dealing with non-believers and dealing with believers sometimes is like nailing Jell-O to the wall. You just can't do it. Try it. Take a glob of Jell-O and put it on the wall and drive a nail through it and see how long it stays there. It's going to hang for a little while and poof. I mean, it's like nailing Jell-O to the wall. It doesn't stick. And then the third one, and this is the only thing that we can control of the three. Our reaction to being misunderstood is ours to decide. And as a good pastor friend of mine used to say, and I borrowed the phrase to the point that it's become my own, and I don't even give him credit for it anymore. You need to pre-decide. Don't wait till it happens, but pre-decide. Typically, people respond to misunderstandings in three ways. Some people get worked up into a frenzy. I've been there. Some people scream and they plead to be understood. I've not been there. And then some people turn it inwardly and play the martyr game. That's not a good place to be either. The best place to be and the hardest place to be is just do what's right for the right reason and the right motives and leave the results to God. You don't have to explain yourself to everybody because not everybody's going to accept it. So Paul was misunderstood. Prior to Paul being misunderstood, Jesus was misunderstood. What makes us think we're not going to be misunderstood? You know? So, next week we'll look at Paul being given a defense, and we'll get to one of my favorite chapters. There's a lot of them, but one that I really, really like and can't wait till we get there is, Paul in front of King Agrippa. That's just, that'd make a good movie. So, and I'm sure God has that on DVR when we get to heaven. All right, thank you for coming, and thank you for your patience. And we will see you Sunday. Deo volentes.